Welcome to the Josh Bolton Show, where we dive into interesting and inspiring conversations. And now, your host, Josh Bolton.
Welcome, everybody. Today we have Aryeh Sim Shinebine. Did I say it correct?
Yes.
Okay. Or I butchered it, but either way, we're going to go into some fun stuff today. Tell us a little about yourself and what you do.
Sure. So I have a full-time job, and my full-time job is I'm a managing director at a global consulting firm. And primarily there, what I do is I value businesses and investments for large hedge funds, private equity firms, investment managers who either buy parts or whole pieces or entire businesses, and they want to know what the business is worth, what the securities are worth. They may own equity, they may own debt, depending on how they make their investments. But probably from the beginning of my career, so like went to college, got a degree in finance, and kind of went to Wall Street, investment banking, and then started getting into venture capital, private equity, and all these things. But I've always also had, I guess now what people would either call side hustles or additional businesses on the side. Mm-hmm. So I got into e-commerce very, very early on and built a number of different ventures in that way, as well as some service providers to e-commerce platforms, merged one of those companies, kind of, have been involved in a number of different ways, and as an advisor to a number of other businesses. So now, in addition to all my other things, one of the things as I did a lot of things on the side and had a lot of other businesses, I met a lot of online entrepreneurs or small business owners, not necessarily online, who were seeing success in their business. So they're getting good, or they are very good at generating revenue or income for their business, but then what to do with that for themselves personally, or how to reinvest it either in their business or for their personal life, is where I think there's a huge knowledge gap for a lot of these people. And it becomes like something that they don't pay attention to or want to, don't even have time for. And so that's where something I work on now, results advisory, that's really what we do. We help people who are looking to understand what to do with their money or how to grow their wealth while staying focused on their business and the mission that their business is trying to accomplish, and help them kind of think about their future and their family's future.
So I'm just curious. I've had a lot of guys on, but it sounds like you might actually have a truly different take. What are some of the tactics you tell the entrepreneurs that are, like, let's say their business is manufacturing paper? They don't have time to look at the stock market. What are some things you'd recommend to them?
Yeah. So I think the first question I would ask them is, if this guy's manufacturing paper or this gal's manufacturing paper, what do they really want out of this paper manufacturing business? Because okay, before we kind of take a look at, hey, do we have time for the stock market or not? Like, I think understanding why you're running your business is really important, because obviously everybody wants to make money. Like that's obvious, right? But how much and to what degree and to what time and to how many years, all these kinds of things. Now, granted, it's not something that people are going to be like off the top of their head, well, I want to do it for 16 more years and I want to, but I think the problem in general is whether we're investing for personal, future, or we're growing a business, a lot of times people don't necessarily have that, lack of a better word, I really don't want to say this, but like have that why, right? They want to spend more time with their family. So why are they grinding more at their business? They're doing 10 million a year in their business. Why are they pushing for 20? Like, what is the trigger that makes them want to do that? Because it may turn out that it's not actually, they're doing something that they actually don't really want to be doing. And understanding like, okay, what is it we're trying to accomplish? Because then we can talk about, okay, I don't have time for the stock market. Okay, that's fine. So the first questions then, when we talk about investing for themselves, really comes down to, let's understand what we're trying to accomplish, right? So what's that goal? And in order to get that goal, we have to understand like, well, we want $10 million. We want $20 million. We want $1 million, whatever the number is. Like, why do we have this number embedded in our head? Sometimes it's arbitrary, but if we can actually make it mathematical, it just makes it easier because it's like a little bit scientific. What I mean by that is a lot of people don't even know how much it costs to lose. Like they don't know their cost of living, and like your cost of living may look very different than mine or vice versa or whatever it is. And so once we actually know what our cost of living is, then we can start to figure out like, okay, what do we want the future to be? Do we want it to be a more expensive future, the same kind of future, you know, somehow magically a cheaper future, which is rare, right?
Yeah.
And so all these things, then I can say, okay, now let's understand what your risk tolerance is. Are you okay with the fact that the S&P has been down 20% year to date? Well, do you have a timeline to adjust for that? Or are you trying to stop running your business inside the next 2 years? And therefore you can't bear having some kind of real major downturn. So understanding the risk reward of all the different asset classes, then we can talk about, okay, what should we be doing with your money, right? So my view in general is I like people to have broad exposure. And what I mean by that is different asset classes. I want people to have some exposure to the stock market. I want them to have real estate. I want them to understand and have some exposure to crypto. I want them to understand what fixed income or other cash flow generating businesses or investments can look like. And so what those returns, like what expectations they can have around returns and things of all these things of that nature. And then we can kind of say, okay, here are the most hands-off way to do this. There's nothing that's like, let's call it truly, truly passive, but there are things that are way more passive than other things. And that's why like I'm a pretty big advocate of what I would call dollar cost averaging, meaning like every month or every week or every 2 weeks, putting money to work, whether it's in the stock market or trying to get other assets, because you're never going to buy at the low and you're never going to know it when it's the low when you buy, and you're never going to know it's the high when you buy. So if you're constantly buying, you're going to be coming out in the middle, right? You're going to be buying sometimes at the low, you're going to be buying sometimes at the high, but over time, you're actually going to do way better than if you're trying to sit on the sidelines and time it and try and get into the market at the perfect time. So I know that's not a direct answer to the question of like, hey, if you have a business, what should I do with it? But I think you have to start to understand the framework and understand yourself and understand like all the assets before you can just like say, oh, this is the one answer. And that's like a big thing of mine. Like, I don't think that there's one answer that encompasses everybody, that everybody can fall into this umbrella and that this is the one thing that's best for them.
No, that's actually the exact answer I was looking for, because you brought up something. I'm just curious. We don't have to go down the whole rabbit hole, but you mentioned crypto earlier. My whole thing is I joke with, because I have a lot of hardcore crypto buddies at my work site. And I'm like, well, the day I can buy on Amazon with Bitcoin or pay the IRS in Bitcoin, then I'll believe it's a thing. Right now, it just feels like it's a Ponzi scheme.
So it's interesting you say that. That you know, utility of crypto or of Bitcoin, right, assumes that it is going to be truly what people call it, a cryptocurrency, that assumes it's a currency. But let's take, and I'm not saying that like the best idea is to put all your money into Bitcoin, but
I know a few people have.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I know a lot who are heavily, heavily, you know, in that as well. But let's extrapolate that for a second and talk about gold.
Okay.
Would you argue that gold is not somewhere that has any value?
It does. It has an intrinsic value. The price may go up and down, but intrinsically, it's a certain range.
Okay. So the reason for that, though, is because people believe that.
Okay.
Right. Like it's not because like if you go into a store today, if you go to Amazon, you're like, okay, I have a quarter of an ounce of gold. You can't buy anything with it. You have to transfer it from the gold into the cash, into fiat dollars. So just at a very high level, like think about Bitcoin in that same regard. It has value, intrinsic value, because people believe that it's going to, people will want it in the future because there's going to be a limited supply of it. Now, you can make the argument that you disagree with that, but it has the similar characteristics of gold in the sense that neither of them produce income, right? Like they're not cash flow generating items. They may be assets, but they're not cash flow generating assets. Now, you probably can more easily take your Bitcoin and make money off of it by lending or doing some things in the crypto space like DeFi or just kind of parking it somewhere where they lend it out and have collateral against it. But gold, it's harder to do that, right? Like if we had like $1 million of gold, we'd probably need an armored truck. We'd need a vault, potentially, you know, armory or something that kind of protects it or protects us. Transporting it is heavy and not simple. Whereas Bitcoin has ways around a lot of those things. Now it comes with other challenges and other belief questions and many other things. But I just wanted to kind of put that frame of mind out there that like it may not be that different from actual gold or silver or other precious metals that really don't have a tremendous amount of usability on something like an Amazon.
Fair. I was basing it off of, I think it's Brazil and a South Africa country is doing it now. That's what I was basing it off of.
Yeah, no, there are countries that are saying that they will take it as currency. The challenge with it in its current form is it's not that it's a little bit slow. It's expensive to to kind of send it around. It's more than it'll probably cost you more than if you were wiring funds from one bank to another. The benefit though for countries like that is that some of those countries, nobody wants the fiat dollars of that country, meaning like the local currency of those countries have tremendous risk for being worthless, whereas Bitcoin may be more stable. Now, granted, Bitcoin has gone from, 7 to 14 to 20, back to 3, now 68, now to 29, 30. Like, it's very volatile. There's no question about it. But it's more transferable than, some of these currencies that kind of become worthless in these foreign countries. But the point is definitely taken. And so I think like, in my view, like depending on your age and depending on your risk tolerance, 1 to 10% of your portfolio, total net worth in crypto. And again, in crypto being like broad, major coins that are viewed as like top 10 assets of the coin era, let's call it. That is something that I could kind of like see and kind of get behind. If you're telling, if we're talking about like 80, 90% of net worth, me personally, that's not where I would recommend it, but it doesn't make me right or wrong. It just, makes my opinion.
Right. Yeah. Cause I've pulled up crypto right now. And last I checked, it was 30K on Friday. Now it's 32,000.
Yeah. It had a big weekend.
So I was just like, wow, that moved super quick.
Yeah.
So then that was going to be my next question. You just tied in at the end. It's like, I guess the other one would be, what would be a wallet provider then you would recommend people, like Coinbase, Cash App kind of thing?
Yeah. So, I'm not a fan of the Cash App type of things, PayPal. Like I believe in those companies. So, those companies and those stocks aside, I think it depends on like what you intend to do. If you're going to be buying Bitcoin, what you intend to do with it. So if we use Coinbase as an example, so Coinbase is what I call a centralized exchange. It's a CEX. Okay. Mm-hmm. And what that means is it's a very easy on-ramp for people who are like north of like 25 years old. The user interface is very similar to everything else we're used to, right? It looks like Schwab or Fidelity, or it looks like our bank, Bank of America or Wells Fargo. Like there's a login, there's, here's your assets, here's your dashboard. It kind of has a nice touch and feel. So it's a very easy on-ramp for the average user who is used to doing something a certain way. If you're actually going to trade, right, like the fees on Coinbase are pretty steep. So like the first and foremost, you can use Coinbase Pro for free. It's the same thing. And the fees are like a third. So if you're actually going to be active with these things, like move away from Coinbase and go to Coinbase Pro. There are a lot of other options, right? There's Binance.us, there's KuCoin, there's Kraken. Each one has like different pros and cons to it. But if you're planning on just buying Bitcoin and putting it away, meaning like you don't plan on using it as a utility of, paying for things, you don't plan on trading it, but you actually just want to say, hey, I have this Bitcoin and I want to put it away, I would almost move to what I would call cold storage, which is something like a Ledger wallet, like getting it off of the exchange. And there's a saying that some people will have is like, if you don't have the keys, you don't own the asset. And so like what that means in Bitcoin world, right? Like in crypto is that when your stuff is sitting on a centralized exchange, like a Coinbase, you actually don't own it physically. And that's actually what triggered probably about 2 or 3 weeks ago. In early May, there was this whole article that came out that people freaked out about with Coinbase. And that was, if the company goes bankrupt, could your assets be part of the bankruptcy liquidation and you not actually be protected? It's unclear if that would be an issue, and no one's saying the company's going bankrupt, but this became an issue back like in 2008 with Lehman Brothers. Like, as these companies were going bankrupt, were your assets part of the company assets, or were they protected as custodial assets for you? And so I think right now in the US, it's very unclear, like, if your assets are at something like a Coinbase, are they protected in the event of a bankruptcy, or are they just part of the company and you don't have it? So the reason I bring that up is not because of like, oh, Coinbase, get it off there. I'm actually not a proponent of like, hey, you got to get it off there. But if you are going to hold this long-term, if you put it on what's called a digital wallet, right? So cold storage, you put it on literally, it looks like a flash drive. Granted, now you are totally at risk, right? Like if you lose this flash drive, you lost your coins, but you are totally in control of it. You own the keys to this asset, and it's not actually online. It's offline. It's in this little hard drive, like a flash drive that you have. There's other ways to do it. You can store it in things like MetaMask, which is, it's a decentralized, you know, it's a Chrome plugin, but it's a personal wallet. And so you don't trade it now on Coinbase or KuCoin. You're actually going to use like things like swaps, like SushiSwap or PancakeSwap or all these, you know, decentralized, so DEX is decentralized exchanges, where there isn't somebody sitting in the middle. There's not a company in the middle. But again, depending on how someone who's listening is like, oh my God, I've lost you. I don't know what the heck you're talking about. Like, yeah, you could use a Coinbase and it's super simple. The problem with like Cash App and PayPal is a lot of these things don't let you get them off. You can't necessarily, I think Cash App allows you to transfer it. You can transfer it to someone else's wallet. But if you look at like the utility and the pricing on some of these things, a lot of it is you can't do what we call like a limit order, meaning like they claim it's the market pricing. So if you go buy stock, let's just use stocks for a second, right? Mm-hmm. Like I go to Schwab and I want to buy Apple stock, and the price is $140 a share. And I say, okay, if it's below $140 a share, I want you to buy a new share. But if it's $140 or above, I don't want you to buy it, right? That's what we call like a limit order.
Right.
Okay. With crypto, a lot of like Coinbase Pro allows for this, a limit order. But on things like Cash App, you just like buy. You buy at the market. Now, because Bitcoin is so volatile, like you said, it was 30 on Friday, it's 32 today, you could end up buying on that app. And really, like, it's 32,000 today, and 3 minutes later, it's 32.5 when you bought it. But really, if you had a limit order, you probably could have bought it for 32, not 32.5. Now, in the big picture, does $500 matter? Well, if you think about it, $500 is pretty meaningful. So, like, those kinds of things, when you're on, like, Cash App and things like that, you're not getting the most accurate pricing. And that's how they're kind of making their money. If they're not charging you a fee, some of them are charging high fees as well. But even
Cash App charges a ridiculous fee.
Yeah. So like all these things, like they're charging a fee and they're not necessarily giving you the best price. So that's why I'm not like the biggest proponent of those types of platforms.
Yeah. It was last year around November when everyone was bugging me to get into crypto. I was like, fine. So I downloaded Cash App because I knew it. And I literally just threw 10 bucks at it. And I was like, all right, here you go. I'm in technically. And it was, I put $10 in and I think it was like $4 they took out.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
But that was just to initiate a trade. And then it was like another $4 to pull it out. And I was just like, so I literally only have $2 to my name after this.
That sounds a bit egregious. I don't know. I would have expected you to tell me it was 5%, but you know, cause that's 40%. Like that's crazy. But
yeah. But it might've been just cause a small order or whatever, but I was just like, yeah, I'm glad I didn't put more in. So, but that's one thing though, as I've talked to different people, have you heard of Rainbow Wallet, by the way?
No, I haven't.
So I guess it's not a full cold storage, but it's not like a Coinbase. I guess it just truly hosts your keys and you can actually do with your keys what you please.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like MetaMask and Trust Wallet. And I think like Ledger, which is a hard, you know, is a cold storage physical one, they're coming up with like a plugin for like Chrome that will act similar. Cause right now it interacts. Like you can have a MetaMask wallet So it's your own wallet. And then it can, you can have it sit on the Ledger wallet, which is offline. Mm-hmm. And when you want to transfer, it kind of just connects to your MetaMask wallet and you can do things. So that's what it sounds like. I've never heard of Rainbow, but it sounds similar.
Okay. Yeah. It was just one of those, a podcaster I listened to. That's the one he uses. I mean, he's funny. He's like, upfront, they don't take care of your taxes for you. So you're going to have to tell your accountant everything.
Yeah. I mean, most of these, like again, that's the difference between a platform versus doing it yourself, right? Like if it's on a centralized exchange, like Coinbase, they'll give you some sort of reporting.
Right. So then let's tie back to stocks.
Sure.
Real quick. So let's say my hypothetical paper company is making a lot and I have 5 million extra. I don't necessarily want it in my name, but I want my company to invest in other assets. How would you approach a client about that?
Yeah. So I think the first question is like, do you own the paper company yourself solely?
Right.
Because like, if you don't, I would definitely advise against investing company money into other assets.
Okay.
So for a number of reasons, one is if you're not the sole owner, now you're sharing this with your co-owners and do they have the same risk tolerance? Do they have the same interest in those kinds of things and what have you? Number two is, when you invest company money into other assets, you now have, let's kind of like play this forward a little bit. 5 years from now, you want to sell your company.
Okay.
And so your company is doing whatever, we're going to make up some numbers. Your company is doing $20 million of top line revenue, and it's throwing off $5 million of net income / EBITDA, depending on how you want to look at this thing. Okay. And so EBITDA, for anyone listening who doesn't know, is earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. And a lot of times when we buy and sell or value businesses, we look at that number versus the net income number, because there are certain expenses that are not really good usage. Because if I were to buy a company that you were running, I may operate it differently. I may put on more debt. I may put on less debt. And so that's the interest component. I may be more tax efficient. And so I would have a lower tax number than you. I may buy better equipment or amortize it differently. So that's why we kind of layer up to this EBITDA number. But anyway, your business is doing 20 million and it's dropping 5 to the bottom. And someone wants to buy it. But on the side, you also have this $3 million asset on the books of an investment in real estate or in this example, stocks.
Right.
And so now you've just muddied the waters in the sense of like, so I'm like, I'm buying this business plus I'm buying your stock holdings, or now I have to buy what's called like it's an asset purchase. So there's two ways to buy a company. I can buy a company through the stock, meaning I just buy the whole thing, or I can buy all your assets and I leave your entity still behind. And so in that purchase, I'd have to leave the entity plus the stock behind. And then as a company, whether depending on what kind of tax reporting you're doing, meaning like if you're an LLC with an S corp, or if you are a C corp, when you do this, you have a separate tax liability for the gains of this, you know, this S&P 500 or whatever the stocks that you've bought. So realistically, let's say again, your business today is doing 10 million, dropping, you know, 12 million to the, you know, 2 million to the bottom line. When you have that $2 million, you're going to pay taxes on it. Mm-hmm. Once you pay the taxes on it, unless you are going to reinvest that money into the business, or you need that money to grow or to buy assets for the business, i.e. more manufacturing or things of that nature. If you want to do anything else with that, including start another business that's totally unrelated or invest, I would recommend taking that out of the business, because you've already paid the taxes. So you might as well now take the distributions out to yourself. Like there's not a lot of advantage of keeping cash there. And so it's the same thing as if you're going to invest in stocks, I would take it out of the business and invest on your personal, or you and your partner, or you and your multiple partners, personal, what I would call balance sheets. Like you want to be investing under your own umbrellas and however you want to do that, because there's tax ways to do that as well. So I wouldn't keep it in the business, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be like, if you really want to get fancy with the taxes, you want to form a trust which owns this, which owns your company kind of thing, or a whole separate one for you?
Yeah. So I'm not a tax expert or professional, nor do I pretend to be one, but that structure, I know people who use that structure, and there are pros and cons and complications and costs associated with all that. So definitely talk to your tax advisor if that's the plan to do that.
Yeah, 100%. So then let's just say I have that $2 million to myself and I'm willing to take on some risk at 32.
Yeah.
Well, what would be the battle plan you would give me?
So, I mean, again, that's still very vague, but let's go with it for the time being.
Okay. Sorry.
No. I'm just saying, like, you're willing to take on risk, but like, I don't know what else you have. I don't know what the numbers you're trying to get to, but like, I get the question though.
Okay.
And so the idea is that, again, like if someone comes with a chunk of money ready to go right that moment, the best thing is not to just boom, dump it all in at that point in time. It goes back to this whole dollar cost averaging. Like I want to ease it in, right? Like right now we may be towards the bottom, but we don't know. Like the market could go down another 20, 30, 40% from here. And if we dumped it all in here thinking like this was the buying opportunity of buying opportunities and we were wrong, that's going to kind of be painful. Mm-hmm. At the same time, like when you bought in November, it was kind of like the high for a lot of that crypto, right? So if you bought at 68 and even now it's at 32, that's kind of a sucky feeling, right? Like you're down half. So you want to kind of be easing into it. Even if it's weekly, I would want that money to start going to work almost like on a weekly basis. And I would also be looking for, I wouldn't just put it strictly in stocks. Like if I had $2 million that I could invest over, let's say the next 12 months or even the next 1 or 2 months that I was trying to kind of get it to work, I'd be looking for different asset classes. So right now, as we're talking today in, you know, last day of May, regardless of when you're listening to this, when you look, there's something that most people rarely ever talk about, and something called an I-bond. An I-bond is the United States Treasury, and it's a pretty unattractive investment vehicle because it's usually like very low interest rates. But the way this thing works is there's two components. There is a rate that's tied to inflation, and then there's a fixed rate that you add to that rate. And so every 6 months, the inflation number gets reset. And the fixed rate is set for the entire life of this investment. The fixed rate currently is zero. So you're going to get 0% plus the inflationary rate. So right now, at the end of April, they set the inflationary rate at like 9.8 or 9.62 or 9.83, something like that. So we're talking about over 9.5%. And so the way it works is you're going to get that for the next 6 months until they reset that rate. So if inflation comes down to, let's say, 7%, though, your rate's going to be 7% starting October. So for the next 6 months, you're going to get like a 9.8% rate of return because it's 9.8 plus zero, which is zero, right? So it's 9.8. And then it will reset. So right now, it's actually a reasonably attractive investment because typically, like historically, it's like the inflationary rates of like 3%. So it's like, it's basically designed to like have you save money and not lose its inflation, right? So it's an unattractive thing. But right now, given that inflation is so high, it's actually a reasonable rate of return. And it's pretty riskless, assuming that you believe that the United States could repay their bonds. That's a whole nother discussion, and we're not going to get into that. But
right.
So the caveats here are you have to maintain, you can't pull your money out for at least 12 months. So you're in for a year.
Okay.
So let's say it drops to 6% in October. So you have a blended rate of like 9.8 and 6, which is still reasonably strong in this environment in the sense of like, where else could you get that rate on a pretty riskless basis? So that's somewhere where someone could park some cash temporarily. The other caveat is, so if you pull it out before 1 year, you can't pull it out before less than 1 year. After 1 year, you can pull it out up to 5 years. And meaning like anytime before it's in for 5 years, the penalty for pulling it out before the fifth year is they take away 3 months of interest. Again, not super meaningful, but the idea is they're trying to keep you to stay longer, but it's fine. Like if you want that money, you can totally take it out, but they'll just take away 3 months worth of interest from you. If you keep it more than 5 years, you get all your interest in whatever it is. So the other caveat, like each individual can only put in like $10,000 a year. But again, this is like a right now point in time this opportunity. If we were having this conversation 6 months ago, it wouldn't have been something I would even mention. 6 months ago, though, I would have talked about something that's more quote unquote crypto related. And I say it in quotes, and that's something called stable coins. Now, stable coins have been in the news a lot lately, right? Because if anyone's following, there was a token called Luna, and Luna basically wiped out, I don't know, $20, $30 billion worth of value in spectacular fashion over a 48-hour period in early May of 2022. But it was tied to a stablecoin called UST. Now, the challenge with that stablecoin was it wasn't pegged to a dollar. It was designed to be called algorithmically pegged to a dollar. And what the heck does that mean? It means that Luna and UST would either be created or burned in order to create this balance that the UST is always at a dollar. The fundamental assumption, though, is that that means that Luna has value. And as long as people believe that Luna had value, that was fine. Well, more or less, people stopped believing that Luna had value, and the whole thing went to hell. Now, there's a lot of speculation of what exactly happened. Okay, but let's leave all this aside. We're going to come back to this idea of stablecoins. There are stablecoins, though, like something called like a USDC. And there are other ones, BUSD, and a number of other ones. But those are truly pegged to the dollar, because for every dollar someone buys in USDC, there is a dollar backing it, or a treasury or a municipal bond backing it. So there's an actual asset that sits there. And so the thing doesn't move. It's tied to the dollar. The SEC got involved. So a company called BlockFi. So this was a platform where I would say, hey, you could go and park your cash, your USDC, and you can get 7 to 9%. The SEC was like, hey, these are securities. This isn't like just an interest-bearing account. And so about, you know, probably the beginning of this year, BlockFi could no longer take US investors' money and give them interest on it. If you had money there, they'll continue to pay you interest. But until they finish registering this as a security, quote unquote, with the SEC, you can't put new cash there. So again, because we're having this conversation today, you can't. Hopefully, though, in the next, I don't know, 90 days or so, they'll reopen to investors and they'll be able to give you interest on that. And so again, that's a very lower risk, but, you know, kind of lower reward. You're talking about like 6 to 9, 8%, you know, type of interest rates. So in terms of things of this nature, like, hey, someone's got $2 million. I'm like, okay, I want them to be, if these are people who want to be pretty hands-off, right? I want them to have weekly investing into the S&P 500, because I think broadly speaking, you know, being in an ETF or an index fund of the S&P 500, you have very, very, very low fees. You're taking on the risk of the 500 largest companies in the United States. Granted, it's pretty weighted to the bigger companies, but that's a whole, again, different discussion. You could do it with the Russell 2000 if you wanted a little bit more broad exposure. There are simple, you know, tickers you can use, like VLO, which is the Vanguard, S&P 500, VTI, which is the total index. So it's like 2,000 or 2,500 companies in these things, super low fees, and you can automatically, you know, set it up that you're buying weekly. You could do it with index funds. It's the same thing, but the index funds are a little bit less flexible than some of the ETFs. There's pros and cons to each one that we're not going to bore everybody with. But those are like, those would be the starting points on the stocks, as opposed to like trying to pick which name you think is going to be the best stock. Like at the end of the day, like, you may pick a winner, but you may pick a loser. But if you're in the S&P 500, you're going to do exactly what the average does. So when you hear in the news that the S&P 500 is up or down, that's what you're doing. And that's okay, because the S&P 500 probably outperforms most funds, most actively managed funds on an annual basis. So that would be where I'd have people starting. I would also have people look at what I would call syndicated real estate deals. So a lot of people are like, oh, I want to have passive income. How does this work, right? So if I told you to go buy your neighbor's house and then try and find a tenant, even if you want to make it a short-term rental, like it becomes like another job, right? Like now you're like, oh, I got to go find a tenant. I got to do the improvements. I got to lift, if I'm going to make an Airbnb or a short-term rental, I got to like, someone's got to manage it. I got to deal with the inflows, outflows. The way I think about it much more, and this is how like I started trying to do that, and I realized like I didn't have that time, is if someone's going to buy an apartment complex of 50 units, 80 units, 100 units, 200 units, they're called the sponsor or the operator. So the sponsor or the operator, typically, you know, when they buy an asset, they buy it like you buy your home. They take a bunch of money and they put it down in cash, and then they go to the bank and the bank gives them a mortgage for the remainder. So it could be, you know, a loan to value of 80%. They can get a loan for 80% of the value. They can get it for 70, 60, something of that nature, maybe as low as 50. But the money that they put down, the sponsor, this operator, they don't like take it out of their pocket and pay it all themselves. Most of the time, they'll put down like 10% of the total amount. So let's say we're going to do a 70-30. So we're going to keep it super simple. It's a $10 million buy. We're going to get a loan for $7 million. And so we're going to put down $3 million of cash. So $3 million of cash, this operator is probably going to put down $300,000, $400,000 of their own. And they're going to raise the rest of it from investors. And so this guy who's got $2 million because their paper business, or this gal who's got $2 million from their paper business, I would say, hey, let's look over this deal. Let's review this. Let's analyze this. What's the upside? What's the downside? What could go wrong? How can we lose this property? How can we make money on this property? What is the cash return we can get every year? What is the average annual return we can get over the life of this? We're going to probably own this property for 5, 7, 10 years. What do we think we can potentially sell for in the future? Maybe it doesn't even go up that much, but every year we're getting a 7 or 8% cash flow in return. And we have benefits. Real estate investing comes with, you know, tax benefits, right? So there's depreciation, there's interest expense. So all these different things, I say, okay, this is going to give me a 7% annual return in cash, 7% cash on cash. But then over the life of 5 to 10 years, I think I can do like 14, 15% plus any of the benefits I'm going to get out of from a tax perspective. This is pretty attractive. I tell this $2 million paper manufacturer owner, you should probably write like a $50,000 or $100,000 check into this or similar types of investments, whether it's multifamily, maybe self-storage, things that are going to generate cash flow. And at the same time, like, I'm going to put up a decent return. Then if we want to talk about crypto itself, we can kind of do it. But those will be probably my building blocks for that person who's looking for a conservative growth strategy that is not overly aggressive, but at the same time, it's not like totally like, hey, let's keep it super simple and let's do 4% in some bond and you know, never make any money.
Yeah, 100%. So then the one thing I was in it for a while was Fundrise. Essentially, it would be the similar thing.
Yeah, so Fundrise and Realty Mogul and all these platforms have kind of come out in the last 5 years or less. It is the same thing. It's like, I think most of their mantras is like real estate for the masses, or access to, you know, the deals that the pros have that the individual doesn't, the retail investor didn't used to get. It's similar. The challenge with those guys is you have to really understand who is making what in the fees and how that is impacting you. And I say that because like the financial service industry is, you know, embedded with all kinds of fee layers, and it's always in the fine print, and you don't necessarily know like what's this, what's that. And it's like, you almost need like sometimes like a degree in understanding the fee structures. And so I have nothing against Fundrise or Realty Mogul or any of these guys. And I think, listen, they're providing a service and they're getting paid for that, right? Like they've built a model where they're making money on that, and that's fair for everyone. But as an investor, you just need to know how that's impacting you. So the person who has $2 million probably doesn't want to go to Yield Street or something like that, or Fundrise or Realty Mogul, only because they probably can go direct to that investment and save all those fees. And so therefore, if you were getting 12% from Fundrise, you probably can get 14 or 15% if you went direct and you wrote a $50,000 or $25,000 or $100,000 check.
Okay. No, that's very fair. I'm just thinking for the person who might not like have these connections kind of thing.
Yes. No, definitely. I mean, I think those, the challenge also with these things is like, Realty Mogul is a little bit different than both Fundrise and Yield Street. And that is, Realty Mogul is presenting opportunities. So they're saying, okay, this sponsor is coming out and he's buying this 200 unit building, and here are the projections. And if you want to invest, write this $10,000 check or whatever the number is. And they're giving you flow, right? What I would call like opportunity, access to things. Mm-hmm. but they're in no way, shape, or form vetting them. Like, yeah, they're not saying that, oh yeah, if it's a scam, we won't know. Like, they'll vet the sponsor, but you could just as well be in a terrible deal and you won't know until later. And the truth is, the same thing happens if you go direct, right? Like, if I have the ability to write a $50,000 check, I may end up being investing in the one bad deal that this sponsor does, right? They do 10 deals, all nine are good, and I invested in the one bad. So I'm not saying that Realty Mogul was any different, but I think all these guys, like, at the end of the day, you're getting behind something that you don't actually know who's doing what. And that's just another thing to be aware of. But yes, if from the perspective of, like, having lower capital, I mean, that's where, like, things like Masterworks is also, like, they're doing, you know, investing in art and in different kind of illiquid assets. Now you have apps like Rally and Collectible, where basically you buy, like, trading cards, sports cards, and or different artworks or jerseys or collectible cars, like, you know, Lamborghinis and all these things. It's definitely an interesting time where you're fractionalizing ownership in things and giving the average person access to it. But it comes with pros and cons, and it's cool. Like, I think, like, I am an early stage angel investor in a lot of businesses as well, personally. And when you do that, like, you know, you're taking on tremendous risk, right? Like, the odds are that company is going to go out of business. But you may have the chance that you're going to do 100x or 1000x. You may be lucky if you get back 1x, right? So right. It's the same thing on these things. You just have to be able to quantify the risk relative to the reward that you can get.
So I'm just curious, because you brought it up. I was eventually going to bring it up, is one of the many stimulus checks I got from the government, I took it and threw it at Masterworks. Is that something you would recommend normally to people?
It's normally. So in general, I don't have anything against Masterworks, and, like, I think it's very interesting.
Yeah.
As someone who deals a lot in the private markets, so I look at Masterworks and I say, like, the assets they own are private markets. I'm defining private versus public is, if I want to sell my Apple stock, it's a publicly traded thing, meaning I go onto an exchange and there's a buyer on the other side, bam, it's $140 a share. Today it's $139. Like, I always know the price, and I have the ability to kind of get in or get out whenever I kind of deem my interest on it. When you start to move things that are private, meaning, like, there is no liquid market for some of these things, you're now kind of, like, in this, okay, who decides the value? Well, let's say there's a sale. Well, then the value has been decided, right? Like, a willing buyer and a willing seller, someone's willing to buy my Andy Warhol picture for $2 million after we bought it for $1 million. Great. Like, we can make $2 million. But if now they've decided that, like, it's worth $1.5 million because there have been comparable sales in the marketplace at $1.5 million. In theory, it's worth $1.5 million, but I have no liquidity on that value. It's kind of like I invest in a private company at a $10 million valuation, and then they go and they raise more money at a $30 million valuation. So in theory, my investment is worth three times what it was, because I invested at $10 million, now it's worth $30 million, but I have zero liquidity. So on paper, I have this asset that's up. So the challenge I have with all of this for the individual, for the average individual, is your paper net worth may be up significantly, or they're touting returns being up significantly. But until there is an actual liquidity event, i.e. an exit or a sale of some sort, it's a little bit abstract. And so that's the challenge with some of the stuff.
Yeah. And that's where I normally wouldn't have invested in it, but it was like one of those, I got an extra stimulus check and I bought what I was thinking. I'm like, screw it, I'll put it at that, see what happens, kind of thing.
Time will tell, right?
Right. One of my buddies was like, he bought into one of the Mutant Ape Yacht Club NFTs.
Yeah.
When it was like dirt cheap too. Mm-hmm. And I said, he's like, oh, why don't you hop in? I'm like, oh, technically I have. It's just time will tell if I was correct or not.
Right. Well, the advantage he has is if he bought direct, he has the ability to sell at any given moment.
Yeah. He did the staking or whatever, where he owns a portion, but whoever owns the main of it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And it was just one of those, I'm like, well, technically you do own a Mutant Ape Yacht Club.
Yep.
But like that one millionth of a percentile.
Yeah. But if in theory that thing goes up, that specific NFT goes up, let's say from 1 million to 5 million, mm-hmm. your whatever fraction will also be up 5x if mm-hmm. there is a liquidity event, right?
Right. So I'm just curious. So like I'm living energy and I realized, how long do I got you for?
We can go to the end of the hour.
Okay, cool. I was just looking like, oh wow, we almost just went over 11. So then you've been dodging this one. I don't know if it's you believe in it or not, or just it's not one you would recommend, is REITs. Mm-hmm. Is that another one people could consider if they're willing to take the risk?
So REITs are publicly traded companies. Well, I mean, most REITs are publicly traded stocks. You could be a private REIT. So REIT is a real estate investment trust, right? And so mm-hmm. the way it works is they're designed this way that the tax rules for those companies are they have to pay out like 90% of their earned income to mm-hmm. shareholders. And so there are times when the yield is defined as the income that the shareholder will get divided by the share price. So sometimes the yield on REITs should be 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9%, depending on where the real driver of what is going to make the yield go up or down is the stock price. So if the stock price is low and they're giving a good cash dividend, then the yield is going to be higher because the cash divided by a low stock price is going to be a higher number. But if the stock price, like in 2020 and 2021, where the stock prices went up, the cash dividend may be the same, but because the price went up, the yield went down. So as an investment strategy, it's a way to have exposure to real estate. There's no question about it. The difference though is that what is your cash yield? So let's say we do this private real estate deal and it's a 7% cash yield. Okay.
Okay.
If we buy this REIT, it may be a 3.5% cash yield. So we're only getting half the cash flow that we would receive. But more importantly is like the price of the stock is volatile, right? Because it's a publicly traded stock. It could go up, it could go down. Mm-hmm. And inherently that's fine, but understand that you're taking what we would call equity market risk, right? Like you're taking stock market risk with this item versus just having real estate exposure risk, right? So if we did this private deal and we were getting 7% cash yield, and we had no volatility in our price, the only time we'd see a change in price is when we would actually sell the property.
Right.
Right. So that comes with pros and cons as well. The pro is if we get into a publicly traded REIT, we could sell it at any moment, just like our Apple stock. We can sell this thing at any given second that we want. The con though is that if we try and sell and they haven't sold any of their assets, or people deem the real estate market to be down in value today because rising interest rates or people are not taking more ownership or whatever it may be, then the stock price may be down, but the real estate asset value like that you're selling it at may be viewed as depressed versus if we held this private one, we wouldn't sell it. We'd still get the 7% cash and we would sell it in 5 years from now when we think the real estate market is back. So, right. There's an offset to a lot of these things. REITs are totally fine. And like I view that as just part of your portfolio. Like as you start to get more, let's call it sophisticated or broad, you can move away from being all S&P 500 and you can say, okay, I want some REIT exposure because you get REIT indexes, meaning like there are indexes that are, or ETFs that are just REITs.
Because I think they're like 2 or 3% expense ratio.
So some of them are. That sounds pretty high. Like I think you should be able to find ones that are under one. Okay. I'd guess probably in the call it 35 to 85 basis points. So like 0.035 to 0.085. I would guess like if you look at Vanguard, they definitely have a real estate one that is well below 2%. Vanguard doesn't have anything that high.
So what's Vanguard's ETF then for real estate?
I don't have it handy, but let's just like Google it while we're at this. Yeah. Index. Oh, so here's a REIT index ETF. Okay. So it looks like VNQ.
VNQ. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So if we look, what do we see here? What is our, do they have an expense ratio? I can't see it on Google Finance.
Let me pull it up real quick. It is 0.17% at max.
There you go. So the other benefit of having something like this is when you look at a REIT, right, there's going to be some REITs that all they do is they own malls, right?
Yeah.
So if you're like, yeah, I'm not really a big believer in the mall model anymore because I'm not really sure how many people shop in stores versus shopping online, or some REITs own industrial, like all these
manufacturing. I think Stag is definitely the industrial one.
I mean, there are a number of them. I think if you look, the other one I would say is like, I think the ticker is, Realty Income. I'm pretty sure they own
a lot of office complexes.
Yeah, but they are typically like what we would call triple net lease, standalone buildings that it's single tenant. So it could be an industrial, or it could be like, think of like a drive-through Starbucks or something like that.
Okay.
And the way those work is the owner owns the property, but the tenant pays for everything. They pay for the maintenance, they pay for the capital expenditures, they pay the taxes, they pay the utilities. So really, all you're doing is you set up a lease, like a 10-year or 20-year lease with the tenant. And if you have good tenants and quality credit tenants, then you don't really have to do much. You're just getting the cash flow from that. You pay the mortgage and that's it. You know, you don't have any other, maybe your property, the property taxes most of the time goes to the tenant pays as well. So those are just, again, like, there are ways to like look at these things and say, hey, does this fit what I want? So if you get an index like that Vanguard one, you're probably going to have a ton of different types. So you'll have pros and cons, right? Like during COVID, nobody wanted to own hotels because they were getting destroyed. But at the same time, like if you were buying, warehouses where people were, using for, e-commerce shipping and things of that nature, you were on fire. So the index probably had exposure to both. But if you had the one REIT that just had hotels, you were probably in a bad position. But if you were in the one REIT that has just third-party logistics, fulfillment centers and things, or warehousing, you're probably doing great. So the index kind of gives you broader exposure to real estate as an asset class.
Very true. We have 5 minutes till 11. So I got three going out questions for you.
Okay, fair.
So other than work, what have you been doing to keep yourself busy during these previous COVID lockdown times?
Sure. So, I'm married, I have four kids. So that in and of itself just keeps
that's busy.
Busy. But we actually spent a lot more family time. We went on family walks. Historically, like pre-COVID, like I coached a number of my kids, different sports, teams. And I'm involved with like a couple of nonprofits, but like, I'd say like COVID taught me like to kind of slow down and have more appreciation and gratitude for just my family and my time with them. I do try and spend more one-on-one time with each kid now, just not collect. I mean, I spend time with all four, but like if I can spend one-on-one time with each one, then I try and do that as well. I tried to learn different skills during some of the lockdowns.
Okay.
I've always been a fundamental investor and a like finance, real, like understanding the numbers, understanding the tech, like the actual fundamentals of the business. So I actually started learning much more technical analysis around like trading and things of that nature.
Me too.
Yeah. And like, I still am not, I'm definitely not a pro. Like there's no, and I also don't have the time to trade, the way a trader would work, right? So a trader is typically more glued to their screen during the hours of operations of the market, or at least when they have exposure. But I wanted to understand like the science behind it to really see if there was validity to it. The other thing is like, I've been able to meet a lot more people online remotely over Zoom, just because people are, we're much more willing to have meetings like this, like the conversation we're having, versus in the past to be like, well, let's meet in person. Oh, calendars don't sync up. Oh, you're across the country, whatever it is. So that's just another thing that, has kind of come. I mean, I read a lot in general. So I read more and I probably definitely listen to a bunch of podcasts and stuff like that more than I did. But I used to have a commute to New York City, whereas since COVID started, I work from home much more. So it's a trade, because in that commute, I would be very productive in listening to audiobooks or podcasts. And now I kind of take that time back. Either, you know, if I do it a walk, I will listen to something or whatever. But
that's awesome. So then the second question is, someone that's inspired by you wants to walk down a similar path. What are some tips, tricks, or advice you give them to start down that path?
So I would definitely say, like, I think now access to information and education is so much more readily available than it was 10, 20 years ago, even 5 years ago. The right. amount you can learn from podcasts like this conversation. I have my own podcast called Inside the Lion's Den. And I would say, like, between YouTube and courses, online education, like, there's lots and lots of things that people can do that I would say, like, back when I was in school, the path was much more of like, okay, I had to network, I had to meet people. And I'm not saying not to network, but it's just a whole different level of access. Like, I couldn't like go on LinkedIn or Facebook or Instagram and find a lot of people. But now, if you consume some content, take some action, and then reach out to people, you'd be very surprised at how responsive people will be, if you, especially once you've taken the action, right? Like, people don't want to be like pestered when, oh, I have this idea or whatever. Like, some people may be willing to, but at the same time, like, if you've taken, hey, you're like, hey, I've consumed all this content and now I've done this, but I'm stuck, or I can you help me, or could you, you know, kind of almost like mentor me or work with me? There's a lot of opportunity today that didn't exist even 5, 10 years ago.
Oh yeah. And especially with podcasting, if you grow it correctly, you can reach out to these heavy hitters and say, I have a podcast. It's in that I've consumed all your information, but I still have questions about one or two things. Could you come on for like 30 minutes and help me clarify that kind of thing?
Yeah, totally.
So then third one is, well, where can everyone contact you at, and what's your show again?
So my podcast is called Inside the Lion's Den. It's not strictly investing. It's all business. And it's also, it's solo and guests. So there's both. The two other sites is, you can head over to solutionadvisory.com or futurefundme.com.
Wonderful. And there should be an automatic email to pick up any links and anything we missed during this conversation.
Yeah. And the platform, I'm probably the most active on Instagram, which is REA the Businessman. But I'm on every platform, but that's the one I'm probably most active on.
Wonderful. It's been an absolute honor and a pleasure to have you on.
It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much. Well, congratulations. You made it to the end. You're an awesome person. Not many make it here. So, being the awesome person that you are, can you do me one more awesome favor? Can you rate and review this on whatever podcast services you're using? App, if you do it on Apple and you leave an actual written review, I have a thing on my website. I will take your written review and post it for all to see. Congratulations, you're permanently sealed on my site. Otherwise, I am trying to do YouTube more and live streaming. I will try to put as many of the YouTube links in the description of the show as I can. So give your boy some extra help over on YouTube. Watch my videos. I just mute it and change the channel, change the window or something. But yeah, that's it. Thank you for being awesome, and see you next time.